ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Friday, the 26th of April. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Today, no more regional towns and cities to rally for urgent action on violence against women. And as thousands of new homes are built to fix the housing squeeze, there are questions about whether they'll meet the population's accessibility needs.
Every day there are more houses built that are not fit for purpose for an ageing population.
I think standardisation of certain things would definitely help so that everybody can just feel like they belong in this world.
First today, the disgraced movie mogul Harvey Weinstein has had his 23-year sentence for rape and sexual assault overturned by a New York appeals court. The court ruled the original jury could have been prejudiced by testimonies of sexual assault that weren't part of the case. Stories told by women detailing alleged experiences with Weinstein kicked off the Me Too movement back in 2017. Campaigners say the ruling shouldn't be seen as a setback for the movement, but as a clarion call. Angus Randall reports.
For more than a decade, Harvey Weinstein was the king of Hollywood. His production companies won 81 Oscars, and when they did, Harvey Weinstein was usually thanked by name.
Harvey Weinstein, Bob Weinstein, God bless them.
Thank you, Harvey Weinstein.
Especially Harvey.
I want to thank Harvey and Bob Weinstein.
I would like to thank Harvey Weinstein.
More than 100 women have publicly aired allegations of sexual misconduct by Weinstein. His downfall marked a turning point in the Me Too movement. Only some of his convictions have now been overturned. Weinstein will remain in prison as he's also serving a 16-year sentence for rape and other sex crimes in California. In New York, many locals are furious at the court ruling.
I gotta say, it made me sick to my stomach. I'm a sexual abuse survivor myself, so the idea that this man, this monster, is getting another shot.
A lot of people are going to be, a lot of women are going to be kind of scared coming out, or they're not going to find it worth it coming out, because it's like, what's the point of me saying somebody sexually assaulted me if the system is not going to do anything about it?
The original New York trial was specifically about two cases of sexual assault, one in 2006 and another in 2013. But the judge allowed other accusers to come forward and tell their story. The New York Court of Appeals found that other testimony risked prejudicing the jury. Weinstein's lawyer Arthur Adala says his client didn't get a fair trial.
But today, Judge Jenny Rivera, a real, real hero for women, said you can't convict someone based on their entire life and everything that they've done in their life. You can't allow more witnesses to come in and testify against the defendant than the defendant is actually charged with.
The New York court has ordered a retrial. It means the accusers relating to these charges will need to again front court and again have their testimony picked apart by Weinstein's legal team. Saxon Mullins is the director of advocacy at Rape and Sexual Assault Research and Advocacy.
It is so difficult to go to trial in the first place, to have to go in front of judges and lawyers and jurors and tell the most horrible thing that has ever happened to you. But to have to do it again because of this ruling, I think is just, it's going to be so, so difficult for those people. And knowing that they have to do it alone, that the evidence of all these other women who have the same stories is not going to be allowed is a horrifying thought. You know, it makes survivors who either haven't disclosed or have gone to the police but are deciding if they want to continue with the trial, it makes them think, why would I do this? Why would I go through all of that to just go through it all again?
She's a sexual assault survivor. Her case went to trial twice. The 5-year court process ended with a judge finding the man involved did not realise she hadn't consented to sex. She says it's horrifying to head back to the courtroom.
So in Australia, we do have laws for this. So if, for example, in my second trial, I didn't have to give my evidence in chief again, I had been recorded and they played that recording in the second trial. So that is certainly something that could be deployed in cases where a second trial is needed. I think the concern is that it's still a harrowing experience, even if you don't have to give that entire evidence. And very often, even if that is played, you will be asked back for further cross-examination or for for further explanation of certain parts of your testimony. So there is always that idea that I might have to be called back again, even if my recording is played.
Next month, Harvey Weinstein is appealing against his Californian conviction.
Angus Randall. Thousands of women are expected to join rallies around the country this weekend to demand action on tackling gendered violence. Women's safety campaigners say so far this year, 26 women have died from gendered violence, 12 more than this time last year. Catherine Gregory reports.
The organisers and attendees of this weekend's anti-violence rallies have a clear idea of what needs to change.
Our first demand, though, is asking Anthony Albanese or the government to come out with a statement saying that it's a national emergency and we want it to be specific to a national emergency.
Sarah Williams is the organiser of the rallies and founder of advocacy group What Were You Wearing? Thousands of people are expected to attend the rallies across the country, from Ballarat in Victoria to Newcastle in New South Wales and most major capital cities. They're calling for immediate action.
Making sure all organisations in the domestic, family and sexual violence sector are funded.
But Sarah Williams says on top of prevention, there needs to be much more support for the aftermath, for the victim survivors of gendered violence. That might include specialist sexual assault courts that deal with gendered violence cases and different ways of tracking and reporting on gendered and sexual violence, as well as mandatory training for frontline workers on preventing victim blaming.
We're really wanting to see our frontline workers, which is, you know, police, paramedics, medical staff and mental health professionals, trained in how not to do anything that might cause the victim survivor any more pain, re-traumatisation.
The rallies come after weeks and months of what appears to be an escalation of violence against women. Just this week, 49-year-old Emma Bates was found dead in the Victorian town of Cobram, and 28-year-old Molly Ticehurst was allegedly murdered in her home in Forbes, New South Wales. They're among 26 women who have died following incidents of gender-based violence this year, 12 more than at the same time last year, according to data from Counting Dead Women.
Women across the country are feeling unsafe. They're feeling distressed, they're feeling angry.
Dr. Hannah Tonkin is the New South Wales Women's Safety Commissioner and says part of the problem is the justice system not protecting women. Molly Ticehurst was allegedly murdered by her ex-partner, who was on bail for other violent offences against her, including rape and intimidation. It's prompted the state government to review the bail laws, which Dr. Tonkin will be a part of.
The group I'll be part of is called the Bail Act Monitoring Group in New South Wales. And I'll be bringing that particular perspective on domestic, family and sexual violence to look at it through a lens of women's safety, the safety of victim survivors.
But would reforming bail laws actually change the way domestic and family violence cases are dealt with? Jane Wagman is an associate professor in the Faculty of Law at UTS.
The law is only as good as the professionals that apply it and enforce it. And at some point, we really have to ask how well those professionals are trained to really understand domestic violence and its risks.
But change is already happening, according to Dr. Hannah Tonkin.
Education and talking to children and young people, that's absolutely critical. And we need to be having these conversations as early as possible in an age-appropriate way, talking about respectful relationships.
The New South Wales Women's Safety Commissioner, Dr. Hannah Tonkin, ending that report by Catherine Gregory. This is The World Today. Thanks for your company. There's mounting evidence basic forms of insurance, financial products once deemed essential, are becoming unaffordable for many Australians as the cost of living crisis deepens. This week's official inflation data showed the strongest annual growth in insurance premiums in 23 years. So is there any relief on the horizon? Reporter David Taylor has the story.
Anna went to the doctor a few months ago with a health complaint. The GP referred her to three separate specialists, but she can't afford to see any of them.
I've got to wait until, you know, we've got the financial space to follow through on one of those.
Anna now spends close to $900 a month on all insurance costs. It's becoming unaffordable, so she's considering cancelling her health insurance policy.
So I think our insurance has probably gone up. It feels like it's gone up $100 in health insurance a month. But it feels like everything has gone up in the past couple of years to double.
This week's official inflation data show insurance prices rising over 16% annually, which is the sharpest increase since 2001. The Bureau of Statistics says higher reinsurance and natural disaster and claim costs continue to drive higher premiums for house, home contents and motor vehicle insurance. The co-CEO of Financial Counselling Australia, Peter Gartland, says home insurance in particular is now out of reach for many Australians.
Yes, financial counsellors are reporting that many of their clients that they are assisting now see home insurance as a luxury.
That's quite extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. In New South Wales, as an example, financial counsellors there are estimating that well over half of their clients would not have any form of household insurance. And furthermore, those financial counsellors working in northern New South Wales are saying that nearly all of their clients that are presenting do not now have any form of home insurance.
The problem, of course, is that without insurance, many Australian households faced being wiped out financially by an unexpected event, perhaps a serious motor vehicle accident. Financial planner Simon Cutler says despite warning his clients of the risks, they insist on cancelling their policies to help put food on the table.
Because clients come in and they're frustrated and they sit there and play definitely a loyalty card because they go, hey, look, Simon, you've put us with this company. We've been happy along the journey. The company's been great. The premiums have been reasonable. But, you know, and they're sitting there going, cancel it. If they're going to do this to me, cancel my cover.
Simon Cutler says more younger Australians are rejecting the concept of insurance entirely and instead opting for crowdfunding platforms like GoFundMe when disaster strikes.
It's quite topical amongst us advisors because we're running around seeing more people without cover in a time when debt levels are so high that, you know, we candidly say, what do people do in the situation? And we said, oh, we're the GoFundMe generation now, when it shouldn't be that. Like, people should be able to afford some form of cover in the marketplace.
Financial counsellors also question the validity of the sharp increases in some premiums. The ABC asked the Insurance Council of Australia to justify the 16.4% annual increase in the overall cost of insurance for the March quarter. A spokesperson told The World Today, quote, wherever you live in Australia, whether you're directly exposed to extreme weather impacts or not, premium prices are rising because of the escalating costs of natural disasters. The growing value of our assets, making them more costly to replace, inflation driving up building and vehicle repair costs, and the increasing cost of capital for insurers.
David Taylor. As Australian states and territories urgently build new homes to deal with a national housing shortage, there are concerns those new builds won't all meet the needs of an ageing population. There are urgent calls for New South Wales and Western Australia to sign up to the mandatory construction code that specifies 7 accessible standards for all new homes. Disability advocates say standardised national accessibility standards are crucial. Alison Shaw reports.
This is my bathroom.
51-year-old V. Samuela has been living in this house in Sydney's southwest for 7 years.
So through here is my bedroom.
It's quite spacious.
It is quite spacious, and it needs to be because we need to have that, be able to move around. Plus there's a whole bunch of equipment and my wheelchair and everything else that needs to be able to function within the room.
But the journey to get here hasn't been easy.
Since I had my strokes 17 years ago now, my life has turned upside down and my whole world has changed. So I was bounced around about half a dozen at least support accommodations over the years. But at least I managed to stay out of a nursing home.
V spent a decade on the public housing wait list.
The shortage of houses that were modified and accessible for me to use were very, very limited. They were impossible to find, actually.
And how much of a relief was it when you did come to see this house?
Oh, it was immediate. Like, we fell in love the second we saw it, basically. We're just doing spins in the living room.
While V. Samuela's house meets most of her accessibility needs, it's still a struggle to go to the homes of family and friends.
It's been almost impossible. I hate that feeling like I'm a burden, or feeling that people are going out of their way to make all these adjustments. If it was just a standard entryway and I could just come and go like a regular person, it wouldn't be such a big deal.
It's why there are urgent calls to implement minimum accessible standards for all new homes in Australia. Former Disability Royal Commissioner Dr. Rhonda Galbally says lack of access to suitable housing leaves grim choices for people with disabilities.
One choice would be to go into segregated housing, into group homes, which is very undesirable, and or they might even go into nursing homes, which is, you know, really inappropriate.
All states and territories except New South Wales and Western Australia have signed up to the mandatory livable housing design standard as part of the National Construction Code. It specifies 7 standards to make sure all new homes are accessible, like step-free entrances and showers and wider doors and corridors. Di Winkler is the CEO of the Summer Foundation, which works with people with disability to help them live in the community.
Both the recent NDIS review and the Disability Royal Commission recommended that both jurisdictions adopt the minimum standards as soon as possible.
In a statement, the Western Australian government says its decision not to sign up came after consultation with industry and stakeholders. It also says it doesn't want to make building new homes more complex or expensive at this time. A New South Wales government spokesperson says they're actively monitoring policy settings, and they say delivering better homes is a priority. Di Winkler says new research published today by the foundation shows that implementing accessible design is achievable, but more training for builders and architects is needed.
What they really need is support from the peaks like HIA and Masters Builders Association to, you know, support their members with the change and disseminate that material and the practical guidance. Because every day there are more houses built that are not fit for purpose for an ageing population.
Back in Sydney's southwest, V. Samuela counts herself lucky to have found this home.
I think standardisation of certain things would definitely help, so that everybody can just feel like, you know, they belong in this world.
That's disability advocate V. Samuela, ending that report by Alison Shaw. One of Australia's largest providers of independent accommodation for seniors has been accused of unreasonably raising rents. That's according to one state regulator in Tasmania. Despite the findings, some rate rises are still being passed on and some tenants feel forced to move out. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
Bronwyn Dodson has lived in Eureka's Glenorchy village in Hobart's northern suburbs for just over 2 years. Recently, the village's managers informed her the rent was going up.
She came to talk to me and she said, I'm come to talk to you about the increase in your rent. And I went, oh, okay. And I thought, this is unusual. Normally, I've lived in two villages before this, two different ones, and the rents have gone up by $10 or something or other. And she said, they're going up $50 a week.
Bronwyn was unimpressed with the $100 a fortnight increase, particularly as the rent is supposed to include meals she claims are sometimes inedible or unsuitable for her diabetic diet.
It's very unaffordable. It's just too much. So, but to me, if I'm going to pay that amount of money, I've got to have really good food, and it's not.
Bronwyn's situation isn't isolated. Over the past 12 months, residents in some of Eureka's 52 villages across Australia have been receiving notices from the company warning of price hikes. At the Hobart village, the price of a one-bedroom unit would increase to $482 a week, or 77% of the age pension. The majority of residents are age and disability pension recipients. Bronwyn decided to fight her increase, taking her dispute to Tasmania's Residential Tenancy Commissioner, along with 24 other residents of Eureka villages in Tasmania.
I challenged the rent increase and I went to the tenancy people and we won. And I now pay $20 a week more instead of $50 a week more.
Tasmania's commissioner found an 11.5% increase was unreasonable and was higher than the rent increase seen in southern Tasmania over the previous year. Although they won, only the residents who fought the increase have received lower rent rises. others still face steeper hikes, despite Tasmania's tenants' union requesting the lower rate be passed on to everyone. It's forced some other residents to consider moving. Julie Rookyard has already left. She secured a social housing property after deciding she couldn't afford to pay more, but she'll miss the friends she's made in her neighbourhood.
I was given a rent increase in February to say that my rent was going up, and it was just out of the question for me, yeah. It was too expensive.
In the outback New South Wales city of Broken Hill, residents in Eureka's Shorty O'Neill received similar rent increases last year. Mayor Tom Kennedy said it had negatively impacted the lives of elderly residents.
A number of residents did tell me they were moving out. Whether they moved out or not, I wouldn't know. But at some stage, a lot of those residents will have to make the decision whether they look for somewhere else. The difficulty we have in Broken Hill is we have one of the lowest rates of vacancy for rental properties.
In a statement, Eureka Group said its rents had remained steady during the COVID period and it was now incurring greater operational costs, including because of wage increases for staff employed under the Aged Care Award and higher food prices impacted by inflation. It says it considers rent increases in each village and each market individually rather than on a national basis, and defended its meals as being primarily nutritious.
Alexandra Humphreys and Adam Holmes reporting. In Australia's far southwest, fingers are crossed in hopes that a pod of pilot whales remains where it should be, in the ocean. About 160 pilot whales stranded themselves at Toby's Inlet near Dunsborough in WA over the weekend. And while rescuers were attending to them, they noticed that some were returning to the water. Whale researcher Ian Weiss is the chair of Geograph Marine Research. We spoke earlier.
When I arrived, there was 160 pilot whales of all sizes in the water, very close to the sand, only probably 2 feet of water, 3 feet of water. And they were very closely packed. Some were in distress, thrashing around, and some had already passed away. There was probably, guessing, 100, 150 people there, and many of them were in the water trying to comfort the whales and help them by keeping their heads above water so they didn't drown. I've been to a couple of other mass strandings over the years, and in those cases, the outcome had been very bad. The 100 pilot whales stranded and only 6 or 7 of them would be saved. And so I had thoughts that out of this 160 on the beach there, there might only be 20 or 30 survive.
What was being done to organise the rescue?
Normal procedure is to wait until they can move all of the whales at once out to sea. So they were waiting for, they needed to get boats and people and so on down there. And in the meantime, the volunteers were just doing the best they could. And before anything could be done to organise a relaunching of these whales, all of a sudden we started to notice that there weren't so many there, and eventually there was, I think, 27 on the beach at that location who had died, and the rest had all gone out to sea on their own.
So the stranded whales righted themselves and took off back out to sea?
Yeah, we just started to say, hey, look, there's some missing, and we started to do some counts, and eventually, in a very short period of time, there was no live whales near the beach. They'd all gone out to sea. There had been some pods further out to sea that were cruising up and down, and just before all those whales left the beach, there'd been a pod go up the beach very close into shore, and that may have been one of the pods from further out to sea coming in and collecting the whales, or it might have been the whales themselves leaving in an organised pod. We don't really know. It happened so fast.
That must have been an extraordinary turn of events.
In a few minutes, it turned from being an utter disaster to something that, while it's unfortunate for the ones that didn't survive, it certainly became a very good outcome.
What do you think can be learned from this? Is there anything that was done differently yesterday that hasn't been done before?
I don't know. The scientists were taking measurements and trying to get data to analyse, and I guess in time they'll produce some findings and recommendations. One thing that did happen was that one of the members of the Geographic Marine Research started organising the people to pull the dead whales out of the water, and this occurred at the same time. I'm not sure whether or not that was connected to them leaving or not.
That's Ian Weiss, the chair of Geographic Marine Research. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Since the Bondi attack, and with the death of yet another young woman, allegedly at the hands of a former partner this week, discussion about violence against women in Australia has been reignited. Today, Louise Milligan on the National Conversation, her own encounters with threats of violence, and why men need to step up. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.